The first one was just kind of a fun, goofy project. I used Kickstarter to raise $30,000 to have Kenny Loggins play in my living room.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was recently in Louisiana, where I had the chance to interview a series of interesting progressive leaders who are located there, including Eric Sanchez. That interview took place in Eric's home in New Orleans, where it was attended by his enormous bear of a dog, who followed the conversation very closely at times. Eric is a political public relations consultant who operates through his firm Quixotic, like Quixotic, and has a history of working for Congressman Tim Ryan and the Public Employees Labor Union, AFSCME. Quixotic consults currently to a project seeking to elect more teachers to local office around the country. Eric also describes a number of his really interesting independent projects involving viral digital marketing and names like Kenny Loggins and Comet Pizza. Eric is also skilled in earned, paid, and digital media, including media planning and execution, speaker preparation, and messaging. Overall, it was a fun and interesting interview. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, then my interview with Eric Sanchez and Quixotic.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, Nathaniel. How are you doing?
I'm good. Mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
You got it. My name is Eric Sanchez, 33 years old. Recently moved to New Orleans from Washington after 32 years. Have a very standard political career for sure.
Do you?
Yeah, I think so, at least. What? You know, starting out and hopping around and doing a lot of campaign work and inevitably...
Where are we right now, just so that... We can set the backdrop because there's some excitement in the neighborhood.
You got it. So we're in my living room right now with my 90-pound lab retriever mix, who we've tried calming down. He's had some breakfast, and hopefully he'll cooperate for just at least through this interview we can make it.
Been kind of all over me.
Yeah, he's very, very friendly.
All right, settle down there, doggy. Oh. Right out of college, you become... communications for Tim Ryan. How did you get to that?
This is an excellent story. So I had done a little bit of work in Virginia, just knocking on doors, something standard, and I'd been interviewing on the Hill. I met, at the time, the chief of staff for then Rep. Kendrick Meek from Florida, and he told me that there was an opportunity, not in the office, but to go work on a campaign under the brilliance of a guy named Brad Bauman, who we all know and love.
Former guest on this podcast.
That's right. Yeah. So I pack up my car. I call Brad and he's like, when can you get here? And I'm like, when do you need me? And he said, yesterday. So I drove out to Northwest Ohio, ended up spending a special election with him. We got to know each other really well. In the process, I got to know his boss at the time, Tim Ryan. And so Representative Meek and Ryan got together and decided to create a role for me working specifically on social media, which... at that time was still in its real...
What year are we talking about now?
The end of 2007, started 2008. Mm-hmm. So it was still in its pretty primitive form, and Twitter was new, and people were still trying to... I was still trying to figure it out. Brad was still trying to figure it out, and only a handful of people on the Hill were really utilizing it.
So you get
it.
To be kind of a pioneer in that space, even though you're a kid.
Right, exactly. I mean, my extent of understanding the tools was kind of using them myself, but that was a good enough basis for me and the other folks doing it. At that time, I felt like leadership was utilizing it. And we would have these digital communicators meetings. And at least when I started, it was maybe only 9 or 10 people. And then by the time I left the Hill in 2011, I mean, you had a full room of, you know, 60, 70 folks that were understanding and utilizing the tools.
So what sort of things did you do with Ryan and me?
So we were creating YouTube videos. We were trying to drive discussions. We're really trying to figure out like how to use these social tools to be able to reach out to constituents. And you know, it was with varied results. It just was so new to see elected officials interfacing using social media. So we just kind of had to figure it out. But the most interesting example, we had a debate between Ryan and John Culberson from Texas. And it was the first time that a Republican and Democrat had some form of debate on Twitter. And it was enough to raise the eyebrows of the Franken Committee to create rules on how to use some of these tools, which was great because it was finally taking attention and obviously great sources of earned media. But, you know, again, just a whole new field. And I thought it was really interesting. And to see how it's being implied now are things, you know, in ways I, you know, we'd never really thought through before.
What was Ryan like to work with?
He was honestly a really nice and decent guy. In terms of the Hill, I'd heard definitely different stories of either good or bad bosses. And especially for communications, I felt like he was really self-reliant. And at least to his staff, just really hospitable, especially under the circumstances, you know, the paychecks there aren't really great. So it was nice to be able to work for someone that really kind of lets you grow into this position. I've always had admiration for him. And you know, I know he's been in different positions in different spots. And sometimes he's made great decisions. Sometimes he's made not so great decisions. I think he's still evolving and trying to figure out where he will land in his next steps. But, you know, in terms of an employer, I just thought it was a really great start. And especially starting on the Hill, I thought working for him was really refreshing.
He's made some noises even about running for president.
That's right. It's so funny because I saw an article yesterday in the Cleveland Plain Dealer of all the offices he had seriously considered running for. And I mean, it's like a laundry list of 14 different positions.
Is he a pretty ambitious?
Yeah, he is, certainly. And I think when he says he's seriously considered these positions, he really has.
He ran for speaker.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I volunteered on that race, and it was interesting to kind of see the infrastructure, as it were, there. I think for him, it's a calculation of a number of different things. He has a family now. He didn't before, which is interesting because I feel like a presidential run would really be difficult, having to traverse around the early states and elsewhere.
It's got to put a lot of strain on a family, I would imagine.
For sure.
Yeah.
And it is difficult. And I know, like, talking to Ohio politicos, they've wanted him to do a number of different things over the years. And he takes the calculated decisions in one direction or another. I feel like it'd be nice to see him elevate, but at the same time, where he's at now and some of the local impact he's tried to, especially being a blue member in a very red district now, he's like in some ways in the epicenter of Trump country and is able to still relate to blue collared workers.
And if by chance Sherrod Brown got on the ticket, that he would be a natural person to run statewide, right?
Right. I would think so. I feel like he and Sherrod line up from a value set and from a platform point almost directly in the same direction. So that would be difficult.
So what else did you learn from that stretch of working in social media on the Hill?
I learned that digital organizing could be really powerful, like understanding not just the messaging and some of the more traditional parts of communication, but really how these digital pieces can help directly communicate in ways that you couldn't with some of the traditional pieces.
If you were here to watch this, you would see two men huddled around the corner of a table and a dog right on the corner going back and forth slobbering on us.
Yeah, that's exactly the visual, which represents, you know, the chaos in this household on a regular basis.
And is one of the reasons that maybe audio is the way to go on some of these things.
Although video would be funny to watch.
Yeah. What did you do next after leaving that position?
I left the Hill. I went back to Ohio. I had, during my time in Ryan's office, had taken a couple leaves of absence to work. I worked at the state party one cycle, and then I left to go work on my first ballot initiative race. It was Senate Bill 5 in Ohio, the collective bargaining bill. My first time working with organized labor, which was a whole new beast to me, just understanding how labor tables work, how those pieces come together, which was a lot different than working on the Hill, right? Just being, and it's different than working on a regular campaign, really trying to organize the efforts.
How was it different?
Well, I felt like organizing efforts throughout a coalition was just, in and of itself, its own job. Just being able to make sure that all those pieces are together and all the different stakeholders feel like they're informed and feel like they're a part of the campaign, especially given all their investments. I thought the structure itself was probably the biggest campaign structure I had worked on, just because we had so many resources given the gravity of the situation in the state.
And how did that campaign go?
We did really well. I want to say, I think we won by about 30, 35 points. Governor Kasich, unlike other collective bargaining bills, made the error of carving in law enforcement and firefighters into collective bargaining. And I felt like from a messaging standpoint, we were able to really...
What does carving in that mean?
He wanted to basically eliminate collective bargaining for law enforcement and firefighters.
So he picked, he added more enemies than he needed.
Right. And those enemies got quote unquote enemies to us, you know, first
allies.
Responders, like teachers, the people that matter. He woke a giant. We had this extremely organized effort with a really grand amount of resources to be able to tackle this bill.
And so you crushed it.
Crushed it. It was decided as soon as the polls were closed, in some ways, even before.
What was your role during that?
I was the deputy communications manager at that point. So I was managing a team of, we had 11 regional communications directors throughout the state with an incredible goal of 3 earned media events a week. By the end of the race, we had organized 552 earned media events. The day after our first signature drop, we held, I want to say about 150, at least 2 in each of Ohio's 88 counties.
Sounds busy.
It was really busy, but it was a really talented team of young people that have gone on to, one of the members of the early team is now Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. Like seeing how those folks have grown and they've gone on to do great things themselves. And it's so interesting keeping tabs and following up with the people you worked with and seeing how much they've grown in their own roles. And that was fantastic.
Was AFSCME next for you? What was next?
That's right. And unbeknownst to me, my role on that campaign was a 6-month job interview. I remember after that campaign had wrapped, I had 2 choices. I'd received an offer to go back to the Hill to be a communications director. And then I had received an offer to go to AFSCME to be a part of their traveling communications team, working on organizing and on the political side.
And for those who don't know, what's AFSCME?
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
A pretty important union.
At least at the time we were checking, 1.6 million members and hopefully somewhere close to that these days. But I can tell you, when I first started out, it took me forever to be able to spell out what AFSCME, the AFSCME acronym.
That's part of the first day training there.
It really is. As a matter of fact, you know, my first week on the job, I had people come up to me and ask me, so what does AFSCME stand for? And I'd be like, the American Federation of, and then I just fumble a little bit. It's like, I swear I know this. I know who comprises it, but that acronym is just so long.
Yeah. It was probably a long branding session to get that one.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure.
So what was your role there at AFSCME and how did it go?
I was living out of a suitcase and my bosses would literally just tell me to go where they needed me to be.
It's a lot of travel.
It was about 90% of my year was based on travel.
What were you traveling to do?
Well, so for my very first role, I was sent down to Florida to help beat back prison privatization. They had a bill working through the Florida State House. Florida, first, that's its own conversation. I felt was a really difficult state to understand, especially from a communication standpoint. But a lot of the work that happened was mostly private pressure behind the scenes and working with our allies to get them speaking out in the media and really beating this back. And we were lucky the vote came down and we were able to defeat that privatization bill at that point. I was sent out to San Diego to work on the mayor's race for a while. I was in Wisconsin for the Walker recall, the first one. I was in Ohio for GOTV. New Jersey was my last assignment in 2013, working on, in the larger sense, the governor's race, but more importantly, the minimum wage bill, just because it, you know, our numbers on that governor's race were tough.
So you're kind of learning the country and its politics through this, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's what I think that's, you know, why I made that decision to go that direction instead of going back to the Hill, because I wanted to try and learn some new skill sets and also get to see the country and understand how people thought and how it was implied in the political spectrum.
So what are a few of the things that you learned through that process?
I learned that sometimes, even when we win debates, it doesn't translate into winning elections. I feel like now when I look at some of the political dialogue and the way that emotionally based messaging really affects people and really has an impact, should be kind of front and center about how our candidates think about messaging.
Say more about that. What do you mean?
Yeah. So I'll use an example. I remember in 2010, I was working in Ohio at the Democratic Party. We were largely working for Ted Strickland, who is up against John Kasich. And during that cycle, we were basically trying to explain the financial bailout to the Ohio electorate throughout the cycle. That's not an easy thing to explain. I feel like The Big Short did a pretty good job. And even then, you still have to wrap your head around a couple of concepts. Whereas John Kasich, his one talking point was 300,000 jobs were lost under Ted Strickland. And that's what he stuck with. And that's what resonated. And we lost that campaign. And I feel like
that wasn't Ted Strickland's fault.
Of course. And not in the least, you know, obviously. If anything, it was more John Kasich's
fault. Or John Kasich's allies.
Right. I remember one of my bosses at AFSCME, she used to say around messaging that she liked to be a part of the water at down caucus. And just like taking
part of the what?
Water at down caucus, meaning, you know, let's take our messaging and figure out a way to make it more palatable and more relatable.
To simplify a message. Abstract out the key points.
Exactly. Yeah. And just figure out a way to make it as translatable as possible to what we're trying to work or deal with. And I feel like for the work that I do now, it's a lot easier thinking of that message that way.
This is definitely one of the most comical interviews I've ever had. I don't have to fend off this giant bear.
Yeah.
And now we have the giant black dog being removed from the area, but now it will start barking.
Just thinking about messaging in and of itself and analyzing what I feel like we'll be up against in the next couple of cycles as a Democrat and looking at the Democratic Party, there's going to be a lot of opportunities to unify. We always had to, but now more than ever, we have to figure out a way to be able to not just reach blue-collar workers, we have to reach progressives, we have to reach every part of our community and trying to figure out what those different messages will look like.
I think a lot of the Democratic presidential primary right now is sorting that out, sorting out what kind of angle we take on 2020. And,
right.
And it really remains to be seen what wins out. And it may be a passionate minority beats a less passionate majority here, or we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, it could reflect kind of what we saw in the Republican primary, right? Where it's like you had 8 or 9 candidates and a lot of them canceled each other out. I personally am kind of just waiting to see what happens. I'm a little overwhelmed with everything.
I can't pick a horse myself. No. There's a lot of people that I like, and then there's the next person I like a different aspect of.
Same. Yeah. And I kind of like wish I could wait until after Iowa.
Well, I think you can.
I think so too. Yeah. I think so too.
But I'm not sure if I trust Iowa to make the right decisions. So,
I've never been a fan of the caucus system. It leaves a lot of people out of the process, I feel. And I mean, I know it's super exciting, but yeah, it is kind of crazy. I've only worked in New Hampshire. This was back in like the early stages of my career. I did advance for John Edwards and we could, that's its own story. But I got to go to New Hampshire for a while and see how that worked. And I just feel like it's a shame that the rest of the country doesn't get to see that level of participation because it's so extreme and intense. And it's like, wow, if only you could allow the rest of the electorate. I know from a resource standpoint, that would be nearly impossible. But just even a glimpse of that information, just intensity that happens in an early state is just incredible.
Yeah, it is. I was a graduate student in Boston in 96, and I went up and watched candidates making their speeches all around New Hampshire and torchlight parades at night and like a lot of old politics going right on there. That was pretty interesting to see.
Yeah.
So to follow in on your biography, what came after AFSCME for you?
After AFSCME, I started consulting. One of my former bosses at AFSCME had an opportunity to have me work with an organization that I work with now, Leadership for Educational Equity. In that role, I work with a bunch of former and current teachers who are deciding to run for office at a hyperlocal level. I get to support them mostly from the living room we're sitting in now, helping them understand their own message and help them storytell and understand.
And this is under the banner of your current firm?
That's correct.
Which is
Quixotic.
Is that how you pronounce it?
That's right.
Because I see that as Quixotic.
Some people say Quixotic.
Yep.
But
you're basing it on Don Quixote.
That's right.
And tilting at windmills.
That's right. And in its form stands for, you know, being completely impractical. And
highly idealistic.
Yeah, highly idealistic. And I feel like, especially for a lot of the activism work I did in Washington, it was a lot of Quixotic-like efforts.
Well, what's the founding story for this firm?
I came down to New Orleans, you know, really
following your lady. Right?
That's right. So my wife is actually, so she is from New Orleans originally. And we were talking about this earlier, and I've heard that if you meet someone from New Orleans and they manage to bring you down to New Orleans, you're likely not leaving, which is okay, because I really like it here. The decision to come down here was basically based on the fact that my work was remote. She was ready to come home, and I still get back up to Washington when I need to, but I didn't have a whole lot, you know, other than my friends, and even my family has now moved to Texas. So,
but before you left DC, you kind of became notable for a few social media campaigns. You want to talk about those and what you learned from them?
Absolutely. The first one was just kind of a fun, goofy project. I used Kickstarter to raise $30,000 to have Kenny Loggins play in my living room.
Wait, how did that get going? What's the story?
I will tell you. I was cruising online one day, and I actually like music from that genre. I used to joke, when you go to your dentist's office, you usually hear a lot of the same soft rock. You know, it's usually like Hall & Oates and Kenny Loggins and all those different artists. So I used to joke that my dentist was my DJ, was my message point for this project. But
few people will admit that, but go ahead.
You know, yeah, exactly. I'm one of those very few people. I noticed on Twitter that Kenny Loggins had his own crowdfunding project for like a passion album. And as part of it, the high dollar item, which I had to contact his management for, was a private performance in your living room with him and his band. Obviously, I didn't have the $30,000 myself. And if I did, I would have used it towards, you know, down payment of a home or something way more practical. I thought, you know, hey, maybe
that'd be a pretty good life experience.
Right, exactly. But I thought to myself, you know, maybe it'd be cool if I never worked with crowdfunding before. I didn't know how it worked. But I decided maybe I'll put my own crowdfunding project together and offer quote unquote seats to a show. And it's funny looking back at it now, because everyone's been talking about the Fyre Festival documentaries. I don't know if you've seen them, but those documentaries follow a guy who wanted to put together a luxury music festival in the Bahamas, and he failed terribly. And, you know, you learn later on that he funneled a bunch of money and all this other stuff, and now he's in prison, and it was a nightmare. And I had folks call me afterwards and are like, you know, thank God that you didn't try to get too ambitious with your project. It just made it a really small and intimate concert. I mean, I wasn't a concert promoter. My career was my career on paper. And
you set out to raise the money to bring a rock star into your own house.
That's right.
And have a few people along with you.
Right.
Yeah. You accomplished this. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. So I finished funding in 2014, and we had the concert in 2015.
I know that you can't just put something up on Kickstarter and have it happen, right?
Right.
It's usually a lot of work to push it forward. So how did you make it happen?
Well, I got to use some of the skill sets that I had learned from work, understanding digital organizing. I used a lot of earned media towards getting toward that goal. And
give us an example.
So it was August of 2014. There was really nothing going on in the news at the time. No, I mean, it was just radio sounds. So I pulled my project together. I pulled an entertainment press list together and just kind of shot it out in the darkness to see what would pick up. A couple of blogs started picking it up, so I started circulating those on my social media platforms.
Kind of making some catnip for the press here.
Right. And at that point, I have and had friends who are working at different outlets, but we never really had reasons to work together. So like my buddy Alan covers immigration for USA Today, and you know, we never had anything to discuss in terms of pitching and just friends. I started doing some local media, and he caught notice of that. So he sent the information over to his entertainment person, who reached out to me. We did an interview. Once that took hold, you know, I was regularly posting updates. After that happened, I ended up getting a call from Kimmel's producers. So then I ended up doing a part of his monologue on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And then after that, it was pretty much just the funding had just been written.
Were you thinking, darn, I could have done this in the pursuit of something more important?
Well, that was the thing. It was funny because most of the folks who'd funded were folks that I'd worked with, you know, and people that were a part of the progressive political infrastructure. And after the dust had settled, they're like, Eric, you got a megaphone. Use it for good. And I felt that.
But how was the actual concert? He actually came to your house, or did you end up having to find a different venue?
No. Well, so my folks at the time lived in Northern Virginia, and I couldn't get him in my apartment for fire code. So we ended up doing it there, which was, you know, it wasn't a problem.
Your parents' house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
was he good?
He was great. Yeah. And he played his hits and played a couple passion project things, but it was different because it was an acoustic set, and it just felt, it was Sunday afternoon and everything was just really, really relaxed. I had different friends who did different things. Like, I had a buddy who has an ice cream truck in DC, and he brought it over, and we figured out different ways to make it special. And
that's awesome.
And it was cool.
The closest I can come to that is there was a fundraiser at my kids' elementary school, and David Byrne from the Talking Heads is the brother of a mother there, or was.
Yeah.
And so the prize, if you kind of put some money into that particular auction item, was you got to go hear David Byrne at my next door neighbor's house give a talk, which is his TED talk. So that was actually my favorite band back in the 80s. So he didn't perform,
yeah,
but he did talk, and we autographed one of his books, and that was a pretty cool thing.
I saw David Byrne last year with a couple friends at Red Rocks, and it was fantastic. And I have to imagine that TED talk was probably super weird and in a different dimension.
It was actually all about how the different sizes of venues over time have affected how musicians perform. So,
right,
like, he's coming up at CBGB's, and it's different than performing in a giant stadium. So it was interesting.
Right. Yeah. No, I have to imagine. He's one of my favorite artists too. But it was.
And Red Rocks is an amazing venue. That's my first rock concert, the Eurythmics, in like early 80s at Red Rocks.
Yeah. I've gone to Red Rocks a couple of times, and it's just the experience of being there is just so much fun.
Natural amphitheater. Yeah. So we've gone far off topic, but there was also something you did having to do with the Comet Pizza.
So this was literally the day after there was a gunman that I went into Comet Ping Pong and fired a couple rounds. Thankfully, no one was hurt.
Because there were these bogus stories,
right,
going around the internet that Hillary was running, like, what was it, a child slavery ring.
Trafficking ring.
Out of this restaurant. It's actually in my neighborhood. It's about 7 blocks from my house.
And it's great. I mean, and you go in there, and it's really just, it's a family pizza joint. And
it was just completely fabricated stories.
Right.
But a bunch of people got exercised, and one person was so upset that they came with a gun and started, they were looking for the cellar door or something where the child slaves were underneath it or something.
Yeah. And so the owner, James Elefantis, he tried his best to be able to squash the rumors. I mean, literally, there was a point where he could have, you know, led reporters through his entire restaurant. And still to this day, there are folks who believe that that trafficking ring is still...
Conspiracy theorists are impossible to persuade.
Right. It wasn't just that pizza place, but a lot of the businesses on that block were getting threatening calls from folks who... We're leaving death threats and other things. And so a food writer friend of mine, Nevin Martell, and I were kind of compelled to organize the community again and just get people to frequent these locales, not just Comet, but, you know, that strip of restaurants that were really getting all these threats and stuff.
So how did you do that?
We created a Facebook event. The way that we got the word out through that, kind of just like with the other projects, we set up the event, reached out to local media, started getting some earned media interest for that. And that weekend, we saw a report in Fox 5 after the weekend was done, and that those businesses had received 3 to 5 times more business than they had.
I saw lines out there,
yeah,
you know, waiting to get in.
It was awesome.
Was that coordinated with a restaurant, or did you just do it out on your own?
Not particularly. I mean, we gave the restaurant a heads up out of respect, because it's just like any restaurateur or bar owner, you know, wants to know when they're going to have a higher volume of business. They don't want to get bombarded. So, you know, we let them know, like, that this was something we wanted to do, but we don't want to overwhelm folks. And obviously, like, the staff was initially shaken up by the events that had happened over the weekend, but when all the support came in, it really made them feel good about, you know, where they worked and what they were doing and the causes of the neighborhood.
When you come back now to your firm and what you try to do for your clients,
yeah,
were those experiences, which are sort of out of the beaten political track, useful to you?
I think so. For the causes that I had on the activism side in D.C., whether it was doing that or whether it was petitioning Jose Andres to leave the Trump Hotel or...
Which he
ended up doing.
Was that, do you think, an impact of your work?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I started petitioning and 5 days later, he was out. He had already been thinking about it in the postmortem articles that were written. It was funny. Someone from the Trump organization had written an email and they're like, we really hope the local community, particularly, you know, the Hispanic and Latino community, doesn't organize against us. I was already organizing against them. Looking back at that, it was just a reminder. When you want to take action, it's really important that the action you're taking speaks to you. There are so many different causes to champion, but you really want to make sure that whether or not you're directly impacted, it's good to be able to have at least some sort of firsthand experience or just the understanding and the empathy that comes with it. It helps if you're organizing a project in terms of fighting bogus immigration laws or Donald Trump's attempts to build a wall, if you know you had an immigrant in your family, or you know, if you were an immigrant yourself, and understanding messaging and the right messengers from that point, it's more impactful, because I see, you know.
So when you go to choose a client, are you looking for that kind of personal connection to what your client is trying to do, or is it more important for them to have that connection?
I think it's kind of a mixture of both. I'll have the opportunity to help with or decide to help with different projects where folks will be looking to do, you know, one big driver push, advocacy push. But I don't like to just take projects for the sake of taking projects, because I think it's unfair to charge people money if you can't provide any modicum of a result.
What is a client that you're working for now, and what are you doing?
So right now I'm working with a teachers group, like I said, and I've been working at this point. I've been with this organization for 5 years. I've worked with at least a couple hundred.
And this is the group that's trying to elect teachers to the local office?
That's right. Starting at the school board level and working its way up city council. And we've had a few state house. Our numbers are pretty phenomenal. Last year we had, I want to say, 73% people of color, 66% women. And really, it's just, these are all people who are just invested from the educational standpoint. And
so how many candidates in total are, would you guess?
Last year, we had 200. I know this year, our goal is to have about 300.
Mm-hmm. And is that across the country?
Across the country.
Yeah. Do you coordinate with any of the other Democratic training groups at all? Or is this all under your own auspices?
This is all under our own auspices for now. I mean, we've been talking about expansion for some bit. I think that's something that's going to be in the cards in the future. Mm-hmm. But at least for now, we're working under our umbrella. But it's an impressive operation. And you know, I know there are others like it. And I know, like, you know, you look at Emily's List and other groups, they do very similar things in terms of offering, you know, on-the-ground resources and things like that. But at this level, looking at these very small races, I think they're obviously getting more elevated now. And I think that was one of the messages that President Obama left us with when he was doing his farewell, was like, you know, this impacted every level. And I feel like in the past 3 years that I've been working with the organization, the electorate has really been kicking the tires harder than ever on these races, looking to see where different resources are coming in. I would say it's a part of a couple of different things. Obviously, still the anti-Trump, just that whole evaluation of that. And also, Betsy DeVos has put a scope on how we look at schools, school safety, obviously, with all the shooting incidents that have happened. So it's like, you know, whereas these races didn't get so much attention in the past, now they're getting a lot more attention. So working with these candidates and helping them understand their value sets. I work with a lot of first-time candidates who have really great and compelling stories to tell, but, you know, they're new to the process, and it's just helping them tell their stories is a lot of what I do. And I think it's the most interesting part, because again, it's like figuring out what they care about, what their values are, and letting that resonate when they...
And is that your sole client then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At this point. And you know,
do you have interest in building this into a firm, or are you mainly just going to work as a consultant on your own?
It's so funny because I look at my friends and colleagues, people like Brad, who have been able to really build up a machine. And for now, I'm happy starting with this and kind of maneuvering and figuring out how I can help. And I understand like being outside of Washington doesn't really help, but I also understand, you know, with all the remote tools that we have, it would be nice eventually to build up, but finding cool partners that have kind of a like-minded sense. But I am in some ways like an independent worker bee. I like to task through, and I'm still learning a lot about firm management and understanding how those pieces work and understanding scale and growth. And I think part of my problem is I like to be able to be 110% invested. And I don't know if that makes me a very good consultant, but at least for now, it makes me a really good person to employ.
Understood. Yeah. You talked earlier about emotion in messaging.
Right.
And I'm curious, when you look at the field, the Democratic presidential primary field, that we're going to pick someone to take on the president, I think he was successful in 2016 in making emotional appeals that made a difference for him,
yeah.
Even though I, you know, don't like his methods. Who do you see sort of having the right angle on this? Say you had the position of advising one of the candidates, what would you tell them to do to combat what we know is coming?
We know what Trump's going to do, I feel. He's going to take a lot of credit for things that he had no responsibility for.
Or that didn't actually happen. Or that did happen.
Right. Or that did happen, but not as an influence of what he did. Whether it was a job growth that kind of started with Obama and came into his direction. And of course, he says, whereas Obama actually inherited a mess, Trump claims he inherited a mess, you know, and all these other pieces. But yeah, that's exactly
right. But you know, he's going to take a simple message and pound it.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's a scary thing is coming from the South. I'm working to stop them. I'm trying to protect you.
Yeah. And honestly, though, it's going to be hard because no matter how folks feel about Bernie Sanders, and by no means is this an endorsement, but you have to admit, like, he was able to get Hillary and the other 2016 candidates to talk about issues that they weren't really going to champion in some regards, the working class issues. And I remember there were a lot of AFSCME members that really liked what Bernie was talking about because he was appealing to a lot of the big issues that labor was tapping into. And despite the fact that AFSCME endorsed Hillary, it was hard. And you know, we saw a lot of labor members fold for Trump. It's going to have to be a happy blend in order to be able to represent what the progressive issues are and also appeal to blue-collar workers and also somehow appeal to pro-life Democrats. Eventually, some people are going to feel left behind. But I feel like this, our litmus test in 2020 is going to be extreme. It's not going to be as easy as people assume. And, you know, for the folks that are holding out for Joe Biden, and obviously I'm a pretty big Joe Biden fan myself, and I always have been. And I just pointed to a painting I have
of Biden eating
ice cream
cone on the wall here.
One of my projects after 2016, I organized folks outside the Naval Observatory to come and like bid farewell. And it was awesome because we actually were able to get his motorcade to stop, and he came out and spoke with us. And his whole message was, you know, I know I'm leaving, but let's give the next, you know, administration a chance. The kind benevolent messaging they had until we saw the chance. And he was like, yeah, this is where we're at now. But it's hard because even looking at Biden in 2008, he's a different brand of candidate. And, you know, there are still people that have their reservations about him. And I appreciate seeing a full-on primary. I hope there are more candidates, and it's something I feel like
there's a very deep field right now, and
yeah.
getting better. And I just hope actually that it doesn't too quickly winnow down to those people who can raise a huge amount of money,
right?
But we get some chance for the small state governors and the other interesting folks that are in it to have a chance and get heard.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I just once we, you know, whittle down to our last three and get to that point, I hope that they are looking at that messaging and making it, turning it around toward the base, and hopefully the party does its part and brings the infrastructure together, and that no one feels like they were slighted and the stuff, the lessons that we learned from 2016. I remember watching both conventions, and you saw the Republican National Convention, and it was, in my opinion, as smooth as it could possibly be. And I remember reading the story about how the DC delegation was considering voting against Trump, and the RNC threatened to just take away their votes. And then we look at ours, and we had pretty much a full-on heckling fest during our keynote. Those pieces are depressing, but it's also great to see that, like, we allow a platform for disruption. I've heard, it's not my line, but I remember I don't know who said it, but it's like, Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And I don't think there's anything wrong with Democrats falling in love.
You list yourself as a public relationist, which is an unusual turn of phrase. And it reminded me of a British series called The Detectorists, which if you haven't seen, you should see. But what do you mean by a relationist?
For that, that's really just a goofy take on being someone in the field. And it's a part of my shtick. One of the values that my colleagues enjoy about me most is that I like to keep it light. I feel like communications in itself is really just can be a tough field. And, you know, especially for the people that love embracing crisis communications and all those other pieces, there's just a lot of burnout and a lot of stress. And I mean, in the political field itself, a lot of us struggle. You know, I see a therapist. I know a lot of other folks that I work with that see therapists. And it's like, the trail can be a really tough thing. And I enjoy consulting now because I just don't feel like I could pack my bag and spend 6 to 8 months somewhere, because it's tough. And it's like, we've witnessed our friends who've dealt with alcoholism and all these other pieces. And it's like, I think we have a responsibility, especially for those of us that are getting older, to bring in a new field of political operatives that see this as still a fun and endearing and causes that are right to do, and really help them understand not just the act of winning races, but the act of personal well-being. And if it's in the form of laughter or humor or things of that nature, I think that's just as important as being able to teach them how to write a press release or understanding media. And we just, you know, we need more of that now. That's
wearing your public relationist hat. If I were to say, okay, I have this niche political podcast where I talk to people like you, how would you get the word out about it?
I would bore people to death by just inoculating them with it every day, which is what I did with all my other campaigns. And it's funny because enough times for me of doing something like that, whether it's hitting my email list a bunch of times or hitting my social media.
You believe in repetition.
Oh, it's important. I mean, the more you say something or the more you post something, it's funny, people will adopt that. If I post 4 pictures of my dog, the next time I see someone in Washington, they're like, "How's your dog doing?" And it's funny, it doesn't.
But not if you do post one.
Right, yeah. Right. And then move on to something else. I think repetition is still super key.
Yeah, I find that hard to like want to put yourself in front of people constantly. To me, there's something aversive about that to me.
Right, yeah. Mm. Since I've moved to New Orleans, I've really dialed it back and I've been listening a lot more. And I've tried to figure out, still kind of invest in how I want to be able to tilt my activism. It's funny, when I moved from D.C. to New Orleans, one of the first things I did was I changed my Twitter location from Washington to New Orleans. The trends in D.C. was like, you know, Mueller, Trump, FBI. And then I changed it to here, and it was like SEC, Sugar Bowl, like all that stuff. And I
different world.
And I looked at that, and I was like, I'm going to need a hobby, because it's like, I don't know what's going to translate here or not, but I still am active and helping out up in Washington. The last project I did was actually with a food writer who I collaborated with on the Comet event. We did a program to give furloughed employees free beers called Pay It Furloughed. We ended up donating over 3,500 beers to furloughed employees. It was definitely a different piece of the puzzle, but it was cool because obviously there was like Jose Andres doing food and other pieces, but we just went directly for the social aspect and we're able to get a bunch of breweries to participate and do something fun. So
I think the lesson there, if there's one, is if you want to, you can make things happen on some scale.
Right.
That is much larger than just you by activating a bunch of like-minded people.
And as long as you're doing it with the right intentions and you literally are putting, and something that we're trying to get the world to understand, people over profits. Something I'm personally proud of, all the projects that I did on the side. I raised $0 for myself. It was literally just projects of passion and projects where I just wanted to be able to offer assistance where assistance was needed.
Well, it's been fun to talk to you today, yeah, despite the large animal at my throat. And I wonder if there's anything else you want to say.
I appreciate you spending some time down here in New Orleans. I hope you enjoy the rest of your time with your family. You know, I really appreciate everything you're doing, the spotlight, you know, the folks that are doing some really great work on our field. I look at the list of talent that we have on our side, and more than anything, I'm happy to be on that side of the fence because I can't imagine what it would be like being on the other side.
So, well, we're glad you're with us too.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Eric. That was Eric Sanchez at Quixotic. I hope he's successful putting more teachers into local office. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.